Hey, it's Francis Lam. You know, we end the show every week with credits for our producers, but now I want to start by thanking you. You know, we're a listener-supported show, and we literally can't make it without you. So if you like what you hear, please head to splendidtable.org and click that donate button. Thank you. And here's this week's show. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lam. It's a presidential tradition. Go to some beloved local hash house, conspicuously eat something, and then watch your approval ratings rise or fall. You could argue that John Kerry lost his campaign in 2004 when he went to Philadelphia and ordered a cheesesteak with Swiss instead of Cheese Whiz. Food is how presidents show America that they're normal people. But inside the White House, food, and the people cooking it, have played different roles. That's according to Adrian Miller, a historian of African-American cooking. In his new book, The President's Kitchen Cabinet, he digs deep into the lives of Black presidential cooks, from the state dinners prepared by enslaved servants, to the meals a Black cook served the president while making her case for the Civil Rights Act, to today. Food in the White House offers a fascinating look at race and power in America. Adrian, so great to have you here.
Yeah, good to be with you.
So in your book, you know, we read about dozens of Black cooks in the White House, from the enslaved to the free and professional, and they play all these different roles. You write about them being babysitters and pitmasters and civil rights advisors and comfort food enablers, confidants, culinary artists, diet enforcers, on and on and on. Mm-hmm. It's amazing you can find records of so many of these people, but I want to first ask you to tell us more about one person in particular.
Sure.
I'm fascinated to know about Hercules.
Right. So Hercules was one of the enslaved cooks for George Washington. And Washington acquires him when he's about 19 years old. He was a ferryman. And he transfers him to the Mount Vernon kitchen where he apprentices under the enslaved cook in that kitchen. And at some point, he takes over duties there. So when Washington ends up in Philadelphia, where the executive residence was while the White House was being built, there was a woman named Mrs. Reed, a white woman, who was the first cook at that residence. And he wasn't too happy with her cooking. So Washington brings Hercules up to Philadelphia and installs him as the cook there.
But Philadelphia was a place where slavery was quasi-legal or not really that legal, right? There was a law that you could only have enslaved people for like a certain period of time.
Right, yes. So there was the Gradual Abolition Act of 1780, which said if you were an enslaved person on Pennsylvania soil for longer than 6 months, you were automatically free. So what Washington did to get around that is right around the six-month deadline, he would pack up all the enslaved people, send them back to Mount Vernon, chill them out there for a few weeks, and then bring them back to start the clock all over again.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that crazy?
That's crazy.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there are all these stories you read about in the book where, like, Hercules was sort of a man about town, and he would walk around Philadelphia, and he had, like, he dressed in this sort of dapper way. And
yeah, so Washington gives him a lot of liberties. He's allowed to go to the opera when his shift is over at night. He gets to dress up like a dandy almost and wear blue vests and suit coats and a golden cane and walk around town. So he was a known personality. I think one of the other cool things is he was allowed to sell leftovers out of the back of Washington's kitchen. And he made about $5,000 in, you know, current dollars selling his leftovers. So you know the brother had skills, real mad skills.
Yeah, it's just fascinating because, like, I feel like when we think of enslaved people, you have a very particular image mm-hmm. of what that life was like. And I'm sure a lot of it is really accurate. But just the story of Hercules, I feel like kind of blows that up a little bit for me and just makes me feel like, oh, there's more to that.
Right. And he definitely breaks the mold. And he was a temperamental chef. There's the George Washington Parke Custis, who was Washington's step-grandson, gives descriptions about all the people that worked for Hercules because he had a biracial staff. So he had enslaved people as well as white indentured servants working in his kitchen. He supervised them in the kitchen, but evidently he would yell and they would just fly at his direction. So I think he would feel a kinship with Gordon Ramsay, you know. But Hercules was a well-renowned chef. People write about him in their memoirs long after Washington is dead. And so we know that he was a great culinary artist of his time.
Yeah. And so, you know, you found all these stories, Hercules being a really notable one, but dozens and dozens of them. Were there any of the cooks that really stood out to you?
I would say, in addition to Hercules and maybe James Hemings, who was one of Sally Hemings' older brothers who cooked for Thomas Jefferson, he was never a presidential cook. But the one that just stays with me is Zephyr Wright, who was the longtime family cook for Lyndon Johnson. And she started cooking for the Johnsons before Johnson enters Congress. And as he rises through the ranks in Congress, many attribute Zephyr's cooking to his establishing his reputation as a great host and a great entertainer. Because back in those days, members of Congress would actually invite other members of Congress over to dinner. That's how you ingratiated yourself and got to know people. And Zephyr Wright's famous Southern cooking was part of the reputation that was built for the Johnsons.
Yeah,
and she actually becomes part of the family. When Johnson becomes president, she sits in the inauguration box with the family.
Wow.
And I don't know of another cook who's done that in presidential history.
Yeah. There's a story that you tell in the book, or just a line, when Johnson signs the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Mm-hmm.
He gives her the pen.
Yeah. So one of the things that people don't know is that Johnson, when he was lobbying for that legislation, that landmark legislation, he would often use Zephyr Wright's Jim Crow experiences to persuade members of Congress to support the bill. Because at that time, the family would drive back and forth from Texas to Washington, D.C. And Zephyr would go along with the family, and she could not go to the bathroom, and she couldn't go to the restaurants at the same time as the family. She suffered so many indignities that she said, I refuse to take this trip any longer. So she would just stay in D.C. year-round.
Hmm.
And so by the time the bill gets passed, that's why Johnson makes this grand gesture to her and says, you deserve this as much as anyone.
But he said you deserve this, not just like you suffered enough.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, she's the kind of person that I assume when you wrote, many of these cooks played roles, including civil rights advisor. I assume she was one of the people you were referring to in that.
Yeah, but I would call her an unwitting civil rights advisor, because if you look at the oral histories that she has left behind, she kind of has this cat and mouse game with Johnson, because Johnson would come and say, well, you know, do black people really appreciate what I'm doing? And she'd kind of say, I don't know, I guess so. You know, she'd be a little coy and things like that. But she definitely gave Johnson, and I think this is the broader role of these cooks in the book, she gave him a window on black life that he may not have had otherwise.
Yeah.
And you know, it was up to a president whether to open that window or not. Many chose to keep it closed, but I think our nation's better for the ones who actually took the time to talk to their cooks and get a sense of what was happening in African Americans in our society.
Yeah. It suggests that there's such a power there, right?
Yeah.
When you have access to someone in those kind of intimate moments, and I imagine for a president too, like a president lives such an incredibly public life.
Right.
That I assume the moments they have that are private, maybe it's just them and their family and just their inner circle and the people who are around at that moment, mm-hmm. you know, that has to have so much impact.
Right. Well, and that's the kind of the role of family confidant that a lot of these cooks serve, because one, they wanted to make the life comfortable for the first family, right? It's a pressure cooker job. You're in a fishbowl in many ways. And so their role was to keep them healthy and happy. And often these foods of the president's childhood or things that they really loved would help, you know, get them through the tough times. But the interesting thing is a lot of people understood the power of the White House cook. When civil rights advocates couldn't get the ear of the president, they would go to the cook and just say, hey, could you just talk to him about this X, Y, or Z? And then the cooks, a lot of times they did. Sometimes they didn't feel it was appropriate. But yeah, they often saw the cook as the avenue to press their civil rights agenda with the president.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's like the hand that rocks the cradle.
Right.
It's the hand on the pan.
Right. Oh, I like that. I might have to steal that.
Thanks so much for coming here, Dan.
All right. Thank you.
Adrian Miller, who worked in the Clinton administration, is the author of The President's Kitchen Cabinet, the story of the African Americans who have fed our first families, from the Washingtons to the Obamas. You can find a recipe from that book, Daisy Bonner's Cheese Soufflé, at splendidtable.org. As someone who learned to slurp minutes after he learned to breathe, I've always been a little disappointed in the phrase noodle soup. I mean, it's really just kind of charmless, like it doesn't know if it wants to be one or the other. So as ramen has become a national obsession, I've had a secret hope that it becomes a gateway bowl and we'll eventually ditch the phrase noodle soups because we'll be on a first-name basis with all of its cousins, like soba and udon and tong min and tong fun and jampong and bun bao wei and laksa and, what we're going to talk about right now, pho. Some people call pho the national dish of Vietnam. It is magnificent. Usually it's rice noodles and a broth that is a super pure expression of beef. But, you know, instead of that hard seared flavor, it's all about this delicacy, this clear soup that's almost sweet with ginger and onion and star anise, and you finish it by plunging in whole herbs at the table. If you don't have a Vietnamese family, you're in luck, because the great Andrea Nguyen has written the Pho Cookbook, and we're talking with her today about why this dish came to be at the center of her table. Hey, Andrea, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's always my pleasure.
So, okay, first, can you pronounce it for me?
Okay, so you have to remember that it's an interrogative, okay? So it's pho.
Try that one more time.
Pho.
Pho.
Exactly, you sound like a native.
Oh, man, that's pretty good. One try.
Yeah, and if you just say that, oh my God, they'll just bring you extra whatever you want.
More meatballs for the gentleman, please.
Yes, yeah. An extra bowl of fatty broth for him over there.
All right. Well, thank you for that lesson. So, you know, lots of cultures have dishes that just make people go, that's it. That's me. That is the food of my people right there. And pho is certainly one of those dishes, I think, for many Vietnamese people. Do you remember your first bowl?
I sure do. In fact, I remember it so well because my family often reminds me of how when I was about 5 years old and we were living in Saigon, I was born in Vietnam, my parents took me to one of their favorite pho joints. And I sat there as a chubby little five-year-old with chopsticks and spoon, you know, in two of my hands, just digging into my bowl and working my way all the way down to the bottom and emptying it. And everyone just thought that it was so wonderful. They marveled at this little kid. And I was hooked on that soup.
This is 1974, as you wrote in your book. And only a year later, your family left Vietnam, coming to the United States as refugees. And so obviously, you know, there are a million changes in your life when that happens. But you seem to remember specifically that when you got here, there was no pho shops to be found.
Yes. What my family gained in terms of freedom, and we were very fortunate to have been able to flee Vietnam a week before the fall of Saigon. And like a lot of Vietnamese refugees, we had very little to bring with us. And we were able to trade, you know, personal possessions for freedom in America. And my family settled in a little beach community called San Clemente, California. But in gaining our freedom, we lost access to pho shops. And I remember like feeling really sad about that. And so like we ended up, you know, making our own pho shop essentially in our home. And my mom would make pho up on Saturday so that we could enjoy it on Sunday morning for brunch after 8 o'clock mass.
Yeah. But, you know, it's thought of as a street food though, typically, right? Is this something that people make at home in Vietnam or is it something you go out for?
Some people make it at home, but most people go out for it. And it is a street food. And so my mother, along with other refugee friends of ours, they would talk about the essence of good pho. And they would trade secrets. And so over the years, that kind of became, you know, the Vietnamese-American pho flavor, which was really kind of like a little more sweet than savory because it's a Saigon-based pho broth.
Oh, that's interesting. It's an unusual food in that it's one of the foods that really has a fairly recent history and yet is, you know, so central to this cuisine and this culture. And there's a pretty definite sense of where it came from and how it sort of evolved over time. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, you know, people look at a bowl of pho and they go, oh my God, it's like this really ancient food. But it's not. It was invented sometime around the beginning of the 20th century. In and around Hanoi. So it's a northern Vietnamese food. Mm-hmm. And if you look at a map of Vietnam, Hanoi is very close to, you know, China's right there. They're our neighbors and they've influenced Vietnam on and off for a total of 1,000 years. And the first pho was invented probably by someone of Chinese origin and sold as street food to a lot of coolies who worked on the Red River. And the reason why pho came about was that the French colonials, and Vietnam was under French colonial power at that point, started slaughtering a lot of cows. Cows are traditionally draft animals. And so there were a lot of spare parts left, you know, tough cuts, bones. And the Vietnamese street vendors at that time had a water buffalo and rice noodle in broth dish. And all of a sudden, there were like these great sales on beef. And they switched the beef for the water buffalo. And they eventually switched the round rice noodles, like the vermicelli type of noodles, for a flat rice noodle, which is what we identify nowadays with pho or pad thai. And then they kept tweaking and tweaking things so that eventually we have pho as what we know it today. A lot of people think that pho is somehow related to French pot au feu, but
because of the name.
Exactly. Yeah. But they're homophones. And there may be something in the notion of how the aromatics are charred at the beginning. Mm. But aside from that, I really don't see a direct descendancy from French pot au feu.
Right. And so if you're making pho at home, what should we know? Are there any, I don't want to say tricks, but you know, are there things that like, oh, people on their first try will often do this when really it's better if you do that?
Right. So on their first try, people want to make sure that they've got plenty of ginger and onion or shallot. But the trick there is to get that kind of sear, that char that I was talking about earlier. You know, one of the things that I've seen in a lot of pho recipes published in the past is that they just throw the onion and the ginger into the pot. That little bit of searing or charring, it slightly cooks the aromatics and converts those sugars and gives a little bit of this sweet heat. And that is part of the foundation of a good pho broth.
Mm, delicious. Hey, thanks so much for coming today, Andrea.
Thanks a lot, Francis.
Andrea's new book is The Pho Cookbook. You can find a recipe for seafood pho, which is not traditional, but totally delicious, at splendidtable.org. You can also find an extended version of my conversation with her there. Coming up, The Key Three with vegetable whisperer Amanda Cohen. And I get to talk with you. I'm Francis Lam, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lam. In our Key 3 series, we ask some of the best cooks and chefs we know for their three most important recipes. You know, the ones they keep in their back pocket and use all the time. The ones they think we should master as well. This week, we're talking to Amanda Cohen, the vegetable whisperer of New York. She's the chef owner of Dirt Candy, and we met up with her in her kitchen.
All right, so here we are in your kitchen. Your industrious crew is prepping behind us. Thank you guys very much. And you are going to make your chickpea tomato rosemary soup.
Yes, exactly. So the thing with, I think, soups at home are either you can go something like really long and complicated, like start with the chicken stock or vegetable stock, whatever, or you can make things really simple and just leave it at that and be like, I just want a hot bowl of something liquidy that's delicious. And the nice thing with this soup is it kind of works with any kind of bean, any kind of other flavoring, any herb. It's really what you have, and you can make it as chefy as you want, as you'll see at the end. So we're starting with the pot. there's a recipe for this, but don't worry so much about how much of each ingredient. You want enough oil to cover the bottom of the pan.
So you're just squeezing a bunch of olive oil into the pan, like no big deal?
Yeah, okay. Like no big deal. I have my little squeeze bottle of it, and it doesn't really matter how much there is. And then I'm putting in about a cup of diced red onions. If you have a white onion, that's totally fine too. And then I have some minced garlic. I'm gonna put in about 2 tablespoons. If you don't like garlic, don't put in that much. And then I also have just a little pinch of chili flakes. You don't want the soup to be too spicy, but it's nice if it has a little back kick. And then we're just gonna mix those up and wait for them to get translucent.
And so, in almost every recipe ever written in the English language, it tells you to get the oil hot first, and then when you throw in the onions, it should sizzle right away, it should be aromatic, and you're not really stressed about that.
I'm totally not stressed, and actually, I think that's a that's sometimes a false thing to do because I don't want my onions to burn. So I can bring everything up to the same temperature if I throw it all in at the same time. I'm sure there's a scientist somewhere who'll be like, no, you have to get the oil hot for this reason. I've never tasted much of a difference. And this way I can make sure that the oil isn't too hot and I don't start burning the aromatics right away.
Great. And so like now it's starting to gently come up to a little bubble and yeah. Like you just kind of like, you know, let that baby ride.
Exactly. But the one thing I really don't want is I don't want my garlic to burn. And I'm turning down the wrong one. Okay, so we were just talking about this. I have like a fancy induction stove, so it takes almost no time.
Yeah.
We're almost at translucent. You can smell it. Now I'm actually gonna just throw in the rest of the ingredients. We'll get a little bit of salt in there. These are canned chickpeas. Feel free to use whatever kind of beans you like.
So just like about 2 cups of canned chickpeas.
Exactly. I'm gonna add in 2 cups of diced tomatoes. Give it a little stir. I'm gonna keep the rosemary whole. I want it to flavor the soup. I don't want to bite into it. Sometimes I find rosemary can get really bitter.
Mm.
And now, I'm just gonna add some water to cover.
And so water, not stock. Like
exactly.
This is like super lo-fi. Like this is something like my grandma would make.
Yeah, I mean it's kind of, without being too disparaging, it's like, you know, peasant cooking. It's like what you have on hand. If I didn't, you know, kill a chicken that day or murder a bunch of vegetables, I would only have water. And that's it, really. That's as easy as a soup can get. We're just gonna bring it to a boil.
And I've resisted mentioning this, but it's almost as if to demonstrate how incredibly simple this is. You're using a pot with no handle.
It's true.
There's no handle on your pot.
Well, this is also, you're getting to see a true kitchen, right? Because I feel like when you do shoots like this and, you know, the chefs always pull out their nicest pots and their nicest spoons and their nicest bowls. No, not a Dirt Candy. Yeah. Not for you, Francis.
Here's my pot. The handle fell off.
Yeah.
I'm cooking.
Yeah. Well, that's coming to a boil. I'm just gonna chop some parsley. There's a couple of ingredients that I think add to a soup that you don't necessarily have to have it. I always consider these sort of like the chef-y ingredients. So parsley, I think it's delicious. I think it's the backbone of the kitchen. I think it makes everything taste better. But if you don't have any on hand, don't worry about it. I'm also gonna add some lemon juice. I think that really, really brightens up a soup. But if you don't have any, also don't panic. You can use a little bit of vinegar. And I have some leftover Pecorino Romano. I'm gonna throw that in too. And I'm also gonna zest some lemon at the very end. But if you don't have it, it doesn't matter.
But like, as a biased observer, I should say like, you should have all these things at all times. Like, I feel like a lemon you should always have.
It's true.
We should start the Parsley Appreciation Society because I feel like, oh, everyone thinks of parsley as like that goofy herb that like sits on the side of your plate at the diner. But it's like, it's super delicious. It tastes like pure green.
It's true.
And it makes everything feel fresh.
Yeah, I feel like it's the salt of the herb world. Like, it really adds that extra amount of flavor to every dish. Now I'm gonna zest a little lemon peel to add at the very end. Again, you don't need it, but it is delicious. And if you have a lemon, then you might as well use the zest. The zest adds a whole level of sweetness that the juice doesn't. Mm-hmm. So it's more of like a whole lemon flavor.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm gonna give the soup a taste for seasoning. Make sure it's okay. Use a little salt. And then I'm going to take out the rosemary. I'm gonna finish this with a little bit of lemon juice. And at this point you have a choice. I have no problem seeing oil on top of the soup, mm-hmm. but lots of people do. And so the way to get rid of that is to take out a cup of the soup and puree it and then add it back in. But you don't have to.
So that does a couple of things. That will thicken the soup.
Right.
But then if you take and puree it and put it back in, it also like sort of helps the oil emulsify.
Yeah, it absorbs all the oil.
And you didn't really cook this for very long. Like it's been boiling for like just a couple minutes.
Yeah, I'm just heating it. I'm hungry, it's lunchtime. I need soup right away. No time. I just added about a half teaspoon of lemon zest. I'm gonna add maybe a little bit more than a tablespoon of the parsley. And then I'm going to take my cheese. Grate a little bit of that on top.
This is pecorino, but I imagine, given where we've gone today, Parmesan would work.
Yeah, anything.
Whatever cheese.
Cheddar, mozzarella. Cheddar. It really doesn't matter. We'll finish with a little bit of fresh salt, and that's it. Would you like to taste?
I would love
our,
to
like,
taste.
Our 2-minute soup.
A 2-minute soup. Dude, that's so good.
Right? It's so simple,
yeah.
But so good.
The lemon zest at the end is actually really great because it doesn't, I think because you add it right at the very end,
right.
It doesn't like meld, and so like it hits you first, and so
that's
you're
right.
Like, oh, cool, lemon, and then it's like, oh, wait, no, it's tomato. Oh, wait, no, it's bean.
So because nothing is cooked very long, what you're getting is a lot of flavor and a little bit of time because nothing has had time to melt. So
yeah.
Think of that as the difference between sort of a more traditional soup where you're getting one flavor, one texture out of the soup, usually sort of like soft. Whereas with this, you have all these sort of punches of texture, and then you're getting hit with the tomato, the chickpea, the onion, the parsley, the cheese, the lemon. So it's like a little like flavor party in your mouth.
It's salad, but a soup.
It's salad, but a soup.
Welcome to Dirt Candy.
Exactly.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having us today, Chef. This is awesome.
Good. I'm so glad. Thanks so much for coming in and joining me in the kitchen today.
Amanda Cohen is the chef owner of Dirt Candy in New York City and is the author of Dirt Candy, a cookbook. Head to splendidtable.org for some of her recipes, including her portobello mousse. Buying a new olive oil is always a little bit tricky, right? It's like, is more expensive really better? What does better really mean? Well, our friends at America's Test Kitchen have been revisiting these questions, which have vexed shoppers since the Aegean Bronze Age. Our managing producer, Sally Swift, talked with ATK's Jack Bishop about their deep dive taste test.
Hey, Jack Bishop, welcome.
Sally, nice to be with you.
So you recently did a tasting of extra virgin olive oil. Now, the spendy stuff, not the supermarket stuff, just to be clear. Can you explain how they're different from supermarket oils?
Sure. We did a tasting of supermarket oils about a year ago, and frankly, only liked one of the 10 oils.
Wow.
Most of them had very little character. They didn't have much flavor. They had some defects. We did some chemical as well as sensory analysis, and we were underwhelmed. So we said, well, you know, there's one that we like that's from the supermarket, but what if you're willing to, you know, go to a gourmet shop or go online and buy a higher quality oil? And frankly, the difference was amazing. This time, 10 oils, we liked every single oil that we tasted.
Wow. And what makes the quality so different between supermarket oils and the ones that you tasted?
So the difference really is that the supermarket oils largely are industrial products sourced from oils. In some cases, they've got oils all over the world, Tunisia, Italy, Spain, that are being blended together in a factory, as opposed to the high-end stuff is an artisanal product. They are growing the olives, they are pressing them, they're bottling them all at the same location. And so it reflects the climate, the terroir of the place where the olives are grown, and much more personality, much more flavor.
Just like wine, right?
Yeah, it really is just like wine. And it's not just tasting. We again sent out all of these high-end oils for chemical analysis. You can look for levels of free fatty acids, peroxides, basically signs that something went wrong either in the processing or in the maintaining of the oil in terms of it's gotten old, it will be oxidized. And the chemical analysis for all these high-end oils came back well above the standards set by the international body that governs olive oil, as opposed to the supermarket oils, either were right on the line or sometimes below the line of what you would be looking for from a chemical perspective for defects.
So in this rare instance, it's actually worth the money. We're getting what we pay for.
You get what you pay for. And, you know, this was actually good news. And so it was so good that we liked every single oil that we tasted. And rather than our usual ranking of our favorite to least favorite, we said, well, let's really group them into four different flavor categories so that people can sort of navigate their own way to find the oil that works best for either the dish that they're making or more likely how their palate is constructed.
That's a really interesting way to do it. And of course, everyone's palate is so different. Do you have a way of figuring out what kind of oil style you would be interested in?
Yeah, we came up with this really clever sort of way of thinking about this. I mean, the big issue here is how peppery and spicy the oil is. And so we said, if you're somebody who likes Chardonnay, if you drink beer and you want a lager, And if you're somebody who likes those mild salad greens, you should be getting an oil from either what we call the mild or the medium categories, with either almost no pepperiness or just a hint of pepperiness. And if you're somebody, say the other end of the spectrum, who loves your espresso, your bitter IPAs, you love your chilies, you should be getting a medium slash robust, or just a plain old robust oil, where in those robust oils, the last thing you taste, it's all about the spice.
It sure is.
And we found oils that fell into each of these four categories and made recommendations for people. You know, if you're somebody who wants a peppery oil, or if you're somebody who wants a buttery oil, we've got choices for you in each group.
Can you quickly go through your recommendations for the mild oils?
Sure. Again, there are probably hundreds of oils that would fall into this category. Mm-hmm. We actually found one from France and one from Portugal that we liked quite a lot. They're available online. Most of these oils are not readily available in supermarkets. The Portuguese oil was Casa de Santo, and the French oil was Moulin Castellas.
Okay, and what about the medium?
So the medium, we loved this Greek oil, which was probably the biggest crowd pleaser. Brand name is Gaia. Mm-hmm. And it just had everything you'd want in olive oil, really, really popular. The other in the medium was Columella, which is actually a Spanish oil that's pretty widely available. It's the one oil that you can find in supermarkets on this list. And again, an oil that we really liked a lot.
And that Gaia is the least expensive of all the ones you've tasted.
Yeah, it was just over $1 an ounce, which in terms of these premium extra virgin olive oils is very reasonable.
And then give me just a couple picks of the robust.
So my favorite is actually the one from California in this category, the McAvoy Ranch from Northern California. And this just is an olive oil that smacks you in the face, but in a good way. I'm actually somebody who likes espresso and IPAs, and I love chilies. So this is an oil that I love. You know, again, if maybe not with a delicate green, but over a piece of grilled fish or a bowl of beans, this is an oil that says, hey, I'm here, and I was made with olives.
And I'm adding something to your cooking. I'm really coming in with something.
It's not just fat, it's flavor.
Exactly. Can you talk to us a little bit about harvest dates? Because I think that's really confusing for a lot of people.
Yeah, the number one thing is to not buy an old oil. After 18 months from harvest, the oil begins to degrade. No matter how good it was to begin with, it is going downhill. And so some bottles have a use-by date, which they could put a date that's 3 or 4 years out from bottling on there. So you want to be looking for harvest dates. The harvest in the Northern Hemisphere runs from October to December. So you want to really be looking at something ideally from the most recent season. So if it's February or March, you may not quite be getting the previous fall, but you're really at the tail end of now an oil that's probably 14 or 16 months old. So it's still okay, but don't buy enough that's going to last you a year, because you really don't want to be using an oil 18 months past harvest date. And so it's really important to be looking at that. It doesn't matter if it's a great oil. If it's an old oil, it will not be worth the money.
And to be clear, the oils that you tasted were all from the Northern Hemisphere, right?
That's correct. We wanted to sort of standardize for harvest dates. So we had basically oils from around the Mediterranean, as well as California oils, which are all harvested in that October to December window. So all the oils that we tasted were the same age.
So what do you use for your everyday oil?
So my house oil is the one supermarket oil that we really liked, which is from California. It's actually a brand called California Olive Ranch. Very widely available. It was the one of the sort of inexpensive oils. It's about half the price of these premium extra virgin olive oils that we tasted that we really liked. And I use it for cooking. Some people don't cook with extra virgin, but I don't really want to keep a low quality oil around just for cooking. So I use it for sauteing, salads. I have a more expensive oil when I really want to taste that oil. But the California Olive Ranch is a very good day-to-day oil.
Great. Hey, Jack, thanks for coming on and straightening this stuff out for us.
My pleasure, Sally.
Jack Bishop is Chief Creative Officer for America's Test Kitchen. You can find the details of that olive oil taste test on our website, splendidtable.org. So coming up, we're taking your calls, 1-800-537-5252. I'm Francis Lamb, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. now I get to talk with you. Give us a call, 1-800-537-5252, or find us on Facebook or Twitter, or email us through splendidtable.org. Hi, we have Catherine on the line. Catherine, how are you?
Hi, Francis. I'm well. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Thanks so much for calling. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Concord, New Hampshire.
Oh, Concord. I love Concord. My best friend's parents live up there.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, it's a great city. Not so great food-wise, so I do a lot of cooking at home instead of eating out. And my question relates to that. Because I don't eat out much, I kind of want to have some quick things during the week that have a bunch of different flavors, like Indian or Thai or, you know, just not the normal thing. And my idea that I want your help to see if I can make it work is that I'd like to make sauces or bases in advance, like a Indian curry base or like a Thai peanut sauce in advance and freeze them. And then during a weeknight, I can look at what I have in the refrigerator and saute up the vegetables, meats, and then add whatever sauce that I defrost.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Well, thank you.
We're done. Okay, next caller. Good job.
No, I wonder why I haven't heard about this idea because it seems so simple, but I'm wondering, like, what are the pitfalls? Like, where can I find a recipe for just the base of things, you know? Because I feel like when I cook these, it's a whole meal, and I just kind of want the sauce.
Sure. Well, I think first things first, when it comes to freezing things, freezing sauces in particular, I think most any sauce, I mean, I'm sure there will be exceptions and you're going to find one and you're going to be like, that Francis, oh! But most any sauce really that you don't finish by emulsifying a lot of butter into will freeze pretty well for you, I think. So like you said, most curries, like a coconut curry or like a peanut sauce or things like that, you can totally make and totally freeze. And what I really like to do is I love to freeze these things in ice cube trays so that you don't have to break out the whole 2 cups and then defrost the whole 2 cups and now you're stuck with that. It might not be the traditional way to have a Thai curry, but you can pop out 2 ice cubes or 3 ice cubes worth of Thai curry and then throw it into, you know, whatever you're sauteing, and you have that flavor even if you're not necessarily making, you know, quote unquote, a whole Thai curry. But I think that way you can also get a lot of variety and you can have a lot of choices through the week if you want. Since you brought up curry, I was thinking, you know, I actually made a curry not too long ago with a Thai woman, and she showed me this really awesome trick, which is you get a can of coconut milk and you open it up, but you be careful not to shake it. And if it's been standing still for a while and you open up, you know, you get that nice thick layer of coconut fat on top.
Yep.
So you take that out and you get it in a pan, you get it kind of hot, and then you fry a curry paste in that coconut fat. And until it starts to smell really good, and you can freshen that up with, I'm assuming you're going to buy some Thai curry paste or.
I mean, I have it already, but yeah.
Oh, terrific. Yeah. So like you fry it in that coconut fat until it's nice and aromatic, and you can freshen it up too if you want to add some fresh minced lemongrass or kaffir lime leaves or even like lime zest. And then when that curry paste is really nice and toasted, you throw in the coconut milk. And you simmer it all until the fat starts to separate out, and that's when it's done. Let that cool, you know, pour that into your ice cube trays, and you can freeze that. And like I said, you can use that as a flavoring. There's also a peanut sauce recipe that another Thai chef friend taught me once that I really love. And it's really simple. You can kind of do it all to taste, but the key is to remember there's a ratio of about 2-to-1 coconut milk to peanut butter. I'm like, oh, do you have to use fresh ground peanut? He's like, I use, you know, just grocery store peanut butter. That's totally fine. And actually, he kind of likes it that way because the fat is nicely emulsified in it, you know, through the magic of chemistry and science and probably things that we don't even want to know about. But and you throw the 2 parts coconut milk and 1 part peanut butter together. Again, a little bit of curry paste to taste, some sugar, some fish sauce, maybe a little bit of vinegar just to balance it out. Tastes good. You bring it to a simmer. And then again, when the fat starts to separate, same thing. Take it off, let it cool, and freeze those up.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. And what about other flavors other than sort of the Thai and Indian? Like I was trying to think of other types that would work, and I was sort of coming up short.
Sure. I mean, I It's funny because the very first time I was on this planet table, I was a guest because I was talking about my ratatouille recipe, which is this. The recipe is on the website, splendidtable.org. But the sort of key to that recipe is you make this really intense tomato pepper jam, where you start by cooking onions and garlic for like a zillion years until they're like melted, and then you throw in these pureed peppers until it's really nice and tight, and then you throw in pureed tomatoes. You cook it all together, and it creates this incredible flavor base that I also freeze in ice cubes trays, but I often will use only half an ice cube because the flavor is so intense. But you pop that out, and you know, that just gives this incredible depth. And it's not like a traditional dish, you know, it's not like, oh, I'm making a curry, I'm making a, you know, a dish you identify, but it'll help you improvise in your cooking. What I like to think about, yeah, is flavor bases, like you said. It's not the whole dish, but just to have different flavor profiles that you can just go to. So that's a great one for the freezer. You can look up recipes for Caribbean or Puerto Rican sofrito, which often is also similar, like onions, garlic, peppers. There's one called Recaito that I love a lot, the Puerto Rican recipe that is cilantro-based. yeah, right? So you kind of get those aromatics going, and you throw in cilantro, puree it up. And typically you would have it fresh, but again, you can totally just freeze it and just like drop it into things willy-nilly.
Oh, yeah. No, that sounds great. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
I'm going to need ice cube trays and a bigger freezer, but I'm okay with that. Thank you so much. And thank you for hosting. I was very excited.
I've been listening for
20 years.
Oh, my God.
And I was very happy to hear that you were going to be the host.
Oh, so, that's amazing. Welcome. Thank you so much.
Yep, definitely. Thank you.
Cool. Have fun.
Bye.
We are talking to you. So call us 1-800-537-5252 or find us on Twitter or Facebook or email contact@splendidtable.org. And we have Lucian on the phone. Hey, Lucian, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing?
I'm well, thanks. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Nashville, Tennessee.
Las Vegas.
Yeah.
I love Nashville. So I understand you have a question for me.
Yes, I do. I've been making risotto for about 6 months now, and it never turns out to be quite as creamy as when I have it in a restaurant, so I'm not sure what I'm doing wrong.
If it's not creamy, is it stiff and goopy, or is it...
Yeah, it's just stiff and starchy.
Okay. Okay, so the first thing is, you're following all the recipes, so you're getting like the Italian rices, like the Arborio or the Vallone Nero or the Carnaroli. You're getting like those kind of rices, right?
Yes.
All right. And when you're making it, you're sauteing the rice in like fat with like, you know, some onions or garlic or whatever. You're doing like the little wine, and then you're like putting in like the cupful a time of stock, or and you're doing that whole thing and stirring the whole thing.
Yes, exactly.
And the texture is like al dente, but not like too hard and not too soft. It's just not creamy enough.
Yes, not creamy enough.
All right, great. So once you have all the variables out of the way, you know you're just dealing with one problem. So I would say a couple of different things. You can A, try that last addition of stock or broth, because when the rice is like pretty much cooked, like pretty much exactly how you want it, it's great to finish it at that point with one more ladle of the broth, stir it in, and kind of shake the pan. And what Italian cooks look for is what they call la onda, which means the wave. You want the rice to kind of splash around like a wave, right? And that'll be a telltale sign that like you have enough moisture in there to give it that creaminess. And then serve it right away. The thing with risotto is that starch really likes to grab water, and it really likes to get gummy and hard pretty quick. So you got to serve it right away and serve it really hot. So if I was really a stickler, I would say, hey, why don't you warm your bowls in the oven or put some boiling water in your bowls and then like dump out the hot water right before you put in the rice. So it keeps nice and warm in the bowl, and so it keeps that nice, silky, creamy texture. Now, the other thing that I want to tell you is a little bit cooler. because, okay, and there's also the thing where like sometimes the recipes will tell you to finish with a pat of butter, and that fat from the butter will also, you know, kind of keep the starch from sticking together a little bit. It's almost like it lubricates it. So that nice big pat of butter at the end of it, stir it in, it sort of emulsifies, and that'll help keep your rice creamy as well. But there is a trick that I learned from a friend who was a cook at the restaurant Per Se. And she says this is how she was taught there, and this is how Thomas Keller tells all his cooks to finish their risotto. And that's you make whipped cream. And you finish it with butter, but then you also finish it at the very end with a big old pat of whipped cream and just fold it in. And you'll never know it's there. It's not like, you know, an ice cream sundae or whatever. But that whipped cream not only gives you A, more liquid to, again, help spread out that starchiness. B, it gives you more fat to help lubricate the starch in the individual grains. And C, it adds air. And that air will keep it a little bit lighter, a little bit silkier, a little bit creamier. And I've just been in love with that ever since she taught me that.
Okay, I'll try those things.
Yeah, let us know how it goes.
I will.
All right. Thanks so much for calling. And everyone else in the universe, give us a call. 1-800-537-5252. Or find us on Facebook or Twitter or email us. And we have Joan Marie calling in. Joan, where are you calling from?
From Lanikai, Hawaii.
Ah, very nice. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I have an overabundance of pureed piri mango in my freezer because my house sitter last year, usually I slice it or keep them whole so that I can make chutney and things like that.
Uh-huh.
But I have all this pureed. So you can only make so many coconut party drinks. And you put a little bit on fish and a little on chicken. And I put some on a 70th birthday cheesecake that was good. But, I mean, I still have a lot in my freezer here because my house sitter thought he was helping me by pureeing all of these mangoes that were sitting in my freezer. Not really.
You know, I love a mango lassi.
That's true. They are good.
Yeah, so you can just take a bunch of yogurt and a bunch of mango puree, maybe a little bit of rose water or just a few drops of orange blossom water. And puree them up into a beautiful drink. And, you know, calcium is good for you.
That's a good excuse.
Yeah. It sounds like if you have all this mango frozen, like if you want to do it where, you know, you can just chip off some or freeze them into small pieces, maybe in an ice cube tray, you can always, you know, not use it as the feature part of a dish. But what I love about mango are the sweetness, the tartness, and certainly the aroma, the flavor. But, you know, you can think about it as a tool, right? And, oh, my God, that's your backyard? Like those birds?
Oh, I'm sitting in my yard, and this is my talking Siamese cat here that's saying it could be half and half time.
You want to switch places for a minute, and I'll figure out what to do in your freezer?
Yeah, really. I know. I know a lot of people in the mainland that are with friends, they don't like me this time of year because it's, you know, 70 degrees right now, easy.
Oh, God. Anyway, getting back to the pot of whatever you're making, you can think of the mango as a tool, right? It's a tool that can bring sweetness. It can bring a little bit of acid. Obviously, you know the flavor if it's more sweet or if it's more tart. And use it to balance things, not as a feature ingredient, but you can just always have it in your back pocket. Hey, I need a little bit of sweetness here. Okay, cool. You can drop a couple spoonfuls of that in there. Hey, I might need a little bit of acid in this vinaigrette. You know, drop a little bit in there.
It does make a really good salad dressing.
That sounds super. And, you know, what I was taught once when I was a cook was the idea of making fruit caramels.
Really?
Caramel sauces. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you make much dessert, but it's fantastic technique when you have a pureed fruit. And this will certainly work for your mango. It can work for bananas. It can work for really any kind of pureed fruit. When you make a caramel, that is, you're boiling the sugar and you're getting it to the color, you know, it's turning into that amber and then turning into a little bit of a darker brown. Traditionally, in most caramel sauce recipes, that's when you will splash in your cream. And that will stop the sugar from cooking.
Yeah.
But you can use a fruit puree in place of the cream. It's not as rich, but you'll bring that freshness and you bring all that great flavor to it. So I would think about that, and it'll be a really cool, complex, interesting sauce for you.
Oh, thank you. That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, so give that a whirl.
All right.
Cool. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Great. Have a good day.
You too.
Aloha.
Aloha. Well, that is the show for this week. It was so great to have you here with us. Thank you so much for listening. Let me leave you with this thought from Thomas Jefferson that I found, believe it or not, in the American Public Media men's room. Whenever the people are well informed, they can be trusted with their own government. You can find information on all the things you heard here today at splendidtable.org. There are tons of recipes on our site, and you can register for a monthly giveaway, take a look at our videos, and sign up for our email newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it'll make Monday to Friday more delicious for you. And we want to go where you're going. Take us along, subscribe to our podcast, and if you really like us, please leave us a review. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell. Our editor and technical director is J. Lou Jennifer Lubke. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. And thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.